Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us today as we talk about attorneys general. You know, Alberto Gonzalez is in the hot seat. He's under investigation for perjury and abuse of power. There is some evidence to suggest that Gonzalez used his official power to advance the cause of the Republican Party in the 2006 midterm elections. We're going to talk about this with Julian Zelizer, who is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's writing a history of the politics of national security, which will be published by Yale University Press. Next year, Harvard University Press will publish a book that he co-edited called Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 1970s. He's also the author of On Capitol Hill and the editor of The American Congress. And good morning, Professor. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This issue of Attorney General is not one that is new to American history. Besides Alberto Gonzalez, there have been others who have come to the headlines as not necessarily in the best light for the president.
Right. I mean, the history of this office is a very contentious history. We've had many people who have been controversial, either because of scandal or either because of controversial actions that they've taken in their official position. One of the people often discussed is John Mitchell, who worked under Richard Nixon. But the office is really a difficult position to be in, and people who want to abuse the power of that office often find a lot of room to do so.
Let's talk about the immediate situation. You posted on the Huffington Post an article called Congress Should Avoid Loyal Friends as Attorney General. Let's talk about that statement.
Yeah, I wrote a couple articles, one in the Post, about the problems that the Attorney General face. And one of the issues that often comes up is you have people who are very loyal to the president. Gonzalez is a case in point. Gonzalez has known Bush from the time that Bush was governor of Texas. He's worked very closely with him. He served various positions in the Texas government and was a person of great assistance to Bush, both as governor and as president. So naturally, when he filled this position, he had dual loyalties in some sense, meaning on the one hand, he was representing the people and representing the law of this country, but on the other hand, he was very much an officer of the president, someone who believed in the presidency and someone who wanted to advance the career of George W. Bush. And I think what we're seeing is those two goals have been in conflict under his leadership, and it looks like he might not have done the best job balancing them.
When you mentioned that they have a long history together, Gonzalez and President Bush, Gonzalez worked in Bush's gubernatorial administration in Texas, but even before then, isn't there some evidence that he has been his attorney?
Yes. I mean, he's often been a close ally of the president from those years, and he even helped. I mean, the most famous case is the evidence that in 96 he helped Bush avoid jury duty in a drunk driving case, and the reason that was important was it avoided and prevented Bush's record with drunk driving from becoming public, which was obviously important politically, although it did come up finally in the election. So these are two men who are very closely tied since the 1990s, and we're not exactly sure when the relationship fully starts. But by the mid-1990s, these are friends, and they are relying on each other in different ways. And Gonzalez has been very close to the entire Bush family, not just the president himself.
I don't know if people are aware that Gonzalez served as Texas Secretary of State from December 1997 to January 1999. Was that an elective post, or was he named by then-Governor Bush?
He was appointed by Governor Bush and to the Texas Supreme Court, of course, which became very controversial because some said he didn't have the judicial experience for that position, and that was a position given to him because of loyalty and friendship rather than experience and recognition that he was the best person for the job. So there's kind of an old issue that he's faced and rooted in the relationship.
We're talking about the role of the Attorney General and attorneys general through history with our guest, who is Julian Zelizer, who is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open for you. In Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll-free number, 800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. I don't recall the confirmation hearing initially for Attorney General Gonzalez, whether or not it was a rancorous one or whether he was confirmed without a great deal of questioning.
There were questions. I mean, there had been questions about Gonzalez's work, not just with Bush. The issues about his relationship with Bush during Texas, I do believe, came up during the confirmation hearings. But more important was his record as the White House counsel. And those were part of the discussion. I mean, you have to remember that Gonzalez was not just the counsel, but he was one of the architects of the war on terrorism for the president. Mm-hmm. A strong believer in presidential power. He wrote a series of memos and helped write a series of memos that, you know, helped to legitimate the use of torture and methods that previously would not have been used, and a strong believer in presidential power. And so many congressmen were nervous about Gonzalez. I mean, this was a person from the start who has not just been loyal to the President Bush, but loyal to the presidency. And that was part of the confirmation hearings. I mean, he still went through rather smoothly given his contentious history, but that has been part of the backstory to the scandals today. I mean, this is a person who has very tense relations with the legislative branch because of what he's promoted through the White House.
And where does Attorney General Gonzalez sit today with representatives of Congress who would like to question him, talk with him, and so far have not been able to get much from him?
I think there's mixed feelings. I mean, on the one hand, I think there are many Democrats and Republicans who are frustrated with Gonzalez. I mean, he has become, in some ways, what Dick Cheney has been, a face and a symbol of the problems with this administration. And his hostility toward Congress and his willingness to be dismissive toward legislative questions during hearings, I think, frustrates many members, including Republicans, who in the end want Bush to do decently and want a Republican White House to do well. So there's a lot of frustration on Capitol Hill. I think many Democrats profoundly dislike Gonzalez. And again, they see him as embodying the problems with this White House and the unwillingness to deal with Congress. On the other hand, I think there's many Democrats who are happy to have him in office. I mean, this has been something some journalists have noted on. But there's a value to having him there rather than out of power. The longer he's there, and the closer we get to 2008, the more his problems become the problems of the Republican Party and not just the Bush presidency.
So then he would be considered a liability, and whether his personal friendship with the president would suffice and keep him in his role would be the test.
Yeah, and so far Bush has been very loyal to him. And in general, Bush is loyal to the people around him, and he is not willing to quickly dismiss people, even people who become the center of controversy. It took him a while with Donald Rumsfeld to finally bow to the pressure. But with Gonzalez, yeah, there is a sense that Bush might hang on for loyalty or for an unwillingness to abandon a person who represents how the administration has conducted the war on terrorism, and that could cost Republicans because it will keep coming back. Congress can keep dragging out the issue, and voters will be reminded of issues such as abuse of power and corruption right through 2008. So there's a certain benefit for Democrats in having him right where he is now.
Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's writing a history of the politics of national security, which will be published by Yale University Press. Next year, Harvard University Press will publish a book that he co-edited called Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 1970s. We're talking today about the role of attorneys general in history. And we've been focusing so far on Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, but there are other attorney generals that certainly whose names will come up as we continue talking today, including Harry Dougherty. And I'm not old enough, I guess, to remember Harry Dougherty. Tell us about his role.
Well, he served under the Harding administration, and when he was named to serve in this role, it was already very controversial. He had a history where he had been accused of corruption while serving in the Ohio legislature. He was a person, when President Harding nominated him, who many thought was not really up for the job. And the real reason he got the job was because he had been a central advisor to the president during the campaign. And he actually ran the pre-convention campaign for Harding. And many people thought this was pretty much a payback for what he had done. And then his time in that office was very contentious. I mean, initially he was criticized. People said that he basically appointed, you know, people who were politically loyal to the president into positions in justice rather than people who really had the experience. And more importantly, he failed to investigate in the Teapot Dome scandal, which was the big scandal of the period that starts to come to light before Harding dies in 1923. And many in Congress are just frustrated that he is covering up a scandal and that he has filled an important department with political hacks. And he becomes, you know, one of the first real symbols of this kind of problem of corruption and loyalty that we have.
Refresh us on the Teapot Dome scandal.
The Teapot Dome scandal is essentially members of the administration were accused of using their power to distribute oil leases, which ended up having personal benefit for members of the administration. So it was using power in the distribution of government programs, basically, for personal gain. And you know, he was involved in many ways, but most importantly, he would not prosecute and he would not go after the people who had been implicated.
He also served under President Calvin Coolidge for a year or so.
He does, and ultimately the pressure on Coolidge becomes pretty intense. There's a Senate investigation going on because, again, the Teapot Dome scandal starts when Harding dies and really kind of picks up actually after he's gone and Coolidge is in office, and Coolidge feels a lot of pressure to have him resign. Many members of Congress are openly saying we can't have this guy heading the office. You know, he's friends with all the people involved. He's never going to take any kind of action, regardless of what he says, and he's as corrupt as the rest of them. And so the pressure intensifies, and he steps down. And that scandal ultimately, does tarnish the Republican Party. It doesn't, you know, destroy their power, but it is an embarrassment at a period where many Republicans were quite excited about their future.
We're talking with Professor Julian Zelizer of Princeton University, where he's a professor of history and public affairs, talking about attorneys general. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Jim Packard. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. Glad to have you with us on this Thursday as we continue talking about the role of the attorneys general in history with Professor Julian Zelizer, who is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And among the attorney generals who have made the news in recent years is John Mitchell, another attorney general who ran campaigns for his president before being named to the post.
Yeah, I mean, Mitchell is certainly one of the most notorious of the people we're discussing. He had known Nixon in the 1960s before Nixon is president. They both were partners in a law firm in 1967. Then he runs Nixon's campaign in 1968. So he's a central player in Nixon's success. And Mitchell is then appointed to be attorney general. And so from the start, this is a relationship where the political and personal ties were very close. And in the next few years, some would say Mitchell, you know, is certainly one of the most corrupt and aggressive people who have held this office.
I recall that his wife, don't recall her first name at the moment, but she was prone to calling the media and talking about John and events at the White House.
Right. There's that personal side of the relationship of what was going in the White House. And you had behind the scenes, you know, what Mitchell was doing. What happens is Mitchell, in his first few years as attorney general, you know, uses his power very aggressively. He refuses to enforce policies on civil rights, for example, that the president opposes. He just won't have them implemented. And he's also willing to authorize wiretaps constantly of opponents of the administration, and members of the administration are wiretapped by Mitchell because people in the presidential White House in close circles don't trust them. So John Sears, for example, the deputy counsel, is wiretapped by Mitchell because Kissinger and Nixon and others are fearful that Sears has too close relationship with reporters and they're not sure about what he wants to say. And then Mitchell resigns in 72 so that he could serve as the head of the Committee to Reelect the President, which is called CREEP, which is the organization that becomes the center of the Watergate scandal. So that's kind of Mitchell's history before and after justice.
What was he convicted of when he was sent to prison?
He is convicted of, I believe, perjury and obstruction of justice. I don't remember the exact charges, but I think conspiracy as well. And he goes to jail in 1975. I believe he gets out in 1979, and he's the first attorney general to go to prison. And he's, you know, a central player in the Watergate scandal.
Let's take some calls. If you'd like to join in, we have two lines open in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Isaac is first in Bloomer. Isaac, what's on your mind today?
Well, I had a bit of a different take on your guest had mentioned that they thought, or he thought possibly keeping Gonzalez on was a good thing for the Democrats. I think that's probably the case, but I also think that Bush doesn't dare let him go for fear that someone else may take that position that may then go after and prosecute Rove and Harriet Myers for misdoings that they participated in. And right now they're protected in ways by him not going after them. And if someone else were to take that position, they may be at risk.
What do you think of that, Professor?
I think he has a very good point. I mean, right now you had all these discussions about contempt of Congress for people refusing to testify in front of these hearings. And one of the big protections they have is that the Justice Department is just not going to enforce that. And, you know, the only other option for Congress when people are not testifying is to hold their own trial, which is just not going to happen at this point. So certain people in the administration are obviously, yes, being protected by having Gonzalez in place, and Gonzalez is not going to budge, it looks like, on these points. On the other hand, I think the point a lot of these journalists are making is that there's still a lot of political value to have this keep coming up. Even, you know, the argument that justice is protecting people who have done bad things can be as potent politically as actually prosecuting people who have done bad things. Again, the cover-up in American politics is one of the most damaging issues for politicians. And by having Gonzalez in there, what the caller just said is exactly the kind of issue many Democrats, you know, have a benefit in terms of having out there in the media. The whole issue of cover-up and secrecy, I think, has been very damaging to Bush in the past few years. It's really turned against the administration.
It should have.
Isaac, thanks very much.
It certainly should have. You bet. Thank you.
We appreciate hearing from you. And if you'd like to join in, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, we're toll-free at 800-642-1234. Let's try Bob in Darlington. Bob, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I'm thinking about the new law that was put into effect here a few days ago, establishing a new system for the FISA court.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the old law, I think, was put into effect in 1979, if I'm not mistaken.
78.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you. And I think that that was had a very broad-based, I think, good system whereby the people who were doing the surveilling, probably the administration, meaning, you know, President Bush and probably Gonzalez and maybe some others in the administration, whoever does that foreign surveillance system, I don't know that, but I know that it goes on constantly. And the point is that they were very liberal, the court, in that they didn't have to report anything in until after 72 hours. Isn't that correct?
I believe that's the time. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think that was a very well-conceived law, and I think that the new law diminishes our it takes away and diminishes our civil liberties, I think. I think it's just a way of increasing potential power towards what I call a unitary presidency, and I don't like it at all.
Yeah, I mean, this is. I think this the law that passed a few days ago is causing a lot of turbulence, not just between Democrats and Republicans, but within the Democratic Party. There's many Democrats frustrated that several went over and voted for this revision and authorization, essentially, of what the Bush administration has been looking for and doing, some say, illegally, unethically, secretly for the past few years. This FISA law in 78, the whole point was to reform national intelligence operations and make sure there's some kind of court supervision when government got involved in these kinds of programs. It all came out of the scandals from Watergate on to the Church Committee that unfolded in the 1970s and revealed what our government did often behind the scenes and without strong authorization. And so this does expand what National Security Agency can do without any kind of real court supervision, and Gonzalez has been an instrumental player on that. You have a question between policy and politics. Again, in terms of policy, many people are very frustrated with the Democratic Party and say that they have caved in on a key issue. In terms of politics, there are some who say this was an issue that Democrats just can't win. That on the war on terrorism and aggressive surveillance, there still is a lot of public support for this. And when Democrats get trapped in debates over this, they tend to lose. So I think that's where we are, but Gonzalez is not an incidental figure to these debates. He has been a very strong proponent of weakening FISA, the law passed in 78. It's been central to this administration in the war on terrorism.
Very good explanation.
Thanks, Bob.
Yeah.
Appreciate your call. And if you'd like to join in to talk with our guest, Julian Zelizer, who is a professor of history and public affairs in the Department of History at Princeton University, give us a call in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Martha Mitchell was John Mitchell's wife, couldn't remember her name there for a minute, but a caller was able to supply that to us. Another attorney general who we should talk about is the role of Robert F. Kennedy when he was President John Kennedy's attorney general.
Yeah, two other notable ones, Kennedy, and we can talk later about Mitchell Palmer, who was another interesting figure. But Kennedy, obviously, was one of the better people to hold this position just in terms of what he accomplished. You know, one of the things he does with justice is a pretty aggressive push and support for the civil rights and voting rights measures that are being debated about in Congress, that the administration is sometimes not getting through Congress, but trying to use justice as a way to obtain stronger voting rights and again, implementation of civil rights. And many give Kennedy a lot of credit for what he does in justice. At the same time, one of the black marks, many say, of his time in the position was his decision to wiretap Martin Luther King and allow the FBI to really gather all kinds of information about this key civil rights leader. So even Robert Kennedy, who is held up as a much better attorney general than a John Mitchell, he has kind of felt intense political pressure, and some said taking decisions purely for politics rather than as a representative of the law.
He was also one of the key figures in the administration's attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro.
Yes, he plays an important role both with the Castro operations, the secret Castro operations that go on, following the Bay of Pigs, as well as a key advisor during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Robert Kennedy is a very close confidant to the president, again, not just in the policy and how to handle the threat that's going on, but in how this is going to play out politically and how Kennedy can survive and the Democrats can survive this through the midterm elections. So, in both those operations, Kennedy was quite important. And, you know, some of the secret operations against Castro also come out in the 1970s and do become part of the impetus to put on some kind of restrictions on what government can do in terms of CIA operations, in terms of assassination and trying to overthrow governments.
You mentioned Mitchell Palmer. I don't recall the name.
Palmer was the Attorney General for Woodrow Wilson, President Woodrow Wilson, in 1919 and 1920. He becomes really one of the most controversial in terms of what he does, not in terms of corruption, but in terms of the policies he supports. He is responsible for a huge crackdown on alleged radicals in the United States as the war comes to an end. The Palmer raids are where the government takes very aggressive action to break up radical groups in the United States who are said to pose a threat, who are said to be allied with the new Russian communist revolution. Many famous people are deported. Hundreds of people are deported from the country, including some very famous radicals. And Palmer also cracks down on organized labor, liberally using injunctions against striking workers. So Palmer becomes a symbol for the excesses of the Woodrow Wilson administration toward the end of the war, the willingness to engage in anti-communist hysteria, the beginning of really the obsession in America with hunting down communists, and the willingness of a formerly progressive government to use its power against labor and against progressive activists. And so Palmer is very popular during the Wilson administration, but by the 1920s he's phenomenally unpopular, and again a symbol of what went wrong with Wilson rather than what went right during the war.
Many of these attorneys general end up running for president. Was Palmer one of them?
He is, and organized labor actually is so angry with him that they help subvert his presidential run in 1920. And that's kind of one of the personal costs that he faces because of what he does to workers in America.
We're talking with Julian Zelizer, who is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, about the role of the attorney general throughout American history. And if you'd like to join the conversation with your favorite candidate for attorney general, then why not give us a call? In Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. In recent times, Janet Reno has been the attorney general for President Clinton and a lightning rod herself.
Yes, she was a lightning rod for conservatives in the United States. Several things that she does really angered many conservatives. One, of course, was the whole Waco incident, which comes pretty early in the Clinton administration and involves a raid on a compound in Texas, about a raid into a religious sect, and the whole raid turns into a disaster when a fire breaks out during the raid, and many say it's because of the FBI, and many of the people in the compound die. And many people kind of attacked Reno. Ironically, the Republicans attacked her as a symbol of Clinton's willingness to use federal power and infringe on civil liberties, kind of a reversal of the politics we're hearing today. And Reno becomes the face of an administration that's not competent in terms of handling law and order. And then she becomes involved in another scandal. She had recommended an investigation, I believe, in 96 into a campaign finance scandal allegations, and investigation doesn't take place, and Congress holds hearings and wants her to release documents involving her own internal deliberations about this scandal, and initially they refuse, and she's cited for contempt of Congress. The administration works out a deal, but again and again she becomes a very polarizing figure for President Clinton, and is used by the right during the 1990s very frequently, as a person through which to mobilize attacks against the Democratic Party.
Do we know what Janet Reno is doing today?
She's ill. I mean, she became ill after she left office. I believe she's in Miami. I don't know exactly what position she has, to be honest.
Our guest is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. We started with Alberto Gonzalez, who had this dual role of representing the president and representing the public as well. If you had to make recommendations to Congress for any way to change the role of the attorney general, do you have thoughts about what that should be?
Well, I do think, I mean, in this position, even more than some of the other cabinet posts, there is an issue of trying to insulate the person from politics as much as possible. It's impossible to fully do that. I mean, these are people who are members of a cabinet. They're members of the White House. They are people who are going to feel a lot of political pressure from whoever the president is. But one of the kind of basic issues we do have to think about when Congress is considering a confirmation is how close is this person to the president before they enter the position. And there are some who say we can't use, you know, loyalty as something that disqualifies people, because we could still have pretty good people in the office. But I think the tension between loyalty to the president and administering the laws of this country are often coming into conflict. And I think with Gonzalez, it was very clear a lot of the problems we faced since he was confirmed. You know, we knew his relationship with Bush. We knew how close the two were. We knew while Bush was in the White House how important he had been to his presidency and to aggressively promoting the cause of executive power. So it shouldn't really be a surprise to Congress that Gonzalez would have trouble keeping the world of politics and law apart. And so I think Congress has to consider this very basic fact, and I think they might want to shy away from having friends, close confidants be appointed to this position.
Have you studied Attorney General Gonzalez's writings at all?
I have actually looked at some of his writings on national security issues. That's what I've seen, the famous torture memo and some of his arguments about how much executive power there really is in an age when we're facing the threat of terrorism. And he has a very expansive view. I mean, he is one of the proponents of what's called the theory of the unitary executive, where there's almost a complete separation of powers, the argument goes, so that Congress almost has no right to infringe on what the executive branch is doing. And in a war against stateless enemies, meaning enemies that are not part of just Iraq or Iran, but a kind of terrorist network that cut across border lines, he's been very strong in saying that there has to be very expansive ideas about how much the executive could do to crack this threat.
Let's go to the phones again to Ben in Milwaukee next. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Very good, thanks.
See, I just had a question, and this is more for my own curiosity than anything, but like when President Clinton was in office and he was having his little fling with Monica Lewinsky, and then he was caught and found to be lying to a federal grand jury, does the attorney general have any responsibility to the country, or are they like a pawn or a puppet for the president? You know, there was a lot of scandal there in that administration, and yet you would think the attorney general would be involved in that.
Well, the attorney general is supposed to not be loyal to the president. They're really not. I mean, they're supposed to be loyal to the law, the chief law enforcement officer of the country. And when we had the special prosecutor law, the attorney general basically had to authorize the investigations. Reno does this for Clinton. I mean, in fact, her authorization of an investigation is important to the Lewinsky scandal even unfolding. And when you have a person in this post who's timid about authorizing investigations into the executive branch, you're likely not to have investigations into the executive branch. And that's a very troubling fact for many Americans. And so they're not supposed to be a pawn, no. I mean, the answer is very clear. But unfortunately, many are. And that's an area where now Congress is quite frustrated. In this issue that we just discussed about people refusing to testify, ultimately, in some ways, Congress depends on Gonzalez to say, well, we'll investigate if people are covering up, if they're guilty for contempt of Congress. But if justice won't do that, it becomes a big problem. So this is a post where you need some separation from the president, more than other policy posts. It's very important, and it's not clear we have that right now.
Ben, thank you so much for the call, and we will continue to take your calls and talk with Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University, about the role of the Attorney General in American history, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you with us today as we continue talking about attorneys general in American history with Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. Let's talk for a moment about Ramsey Clark, and what are your thoughts about Attorney General Clark?
Clark is also, a pretty more polarizing attorney general than really a scandalous attorney general. He is in power at a very contentious time in American politics as the Johnson administration is finishing up and the war in Vietnam is raging in the United States and the country is very divided. Clark was generally seen as a person, an ally of the left and someone who is sympathetic to many of the arguments that were being made against the administration, but at the same time he held a position where he often authorized actions against New Left protesters or agreed to them that many were unhappy with. And I think with Clark you had a kind of unusual person who was in a position at a very hard time to hold that office. And he's kind of remained a symbol of the politics of that era.
He's one of the few attorney general who continues to make news years after he's out of office.
He is. I mean, in some ways, he's a little like the other person who did was Ed Meese.
Mm-hmm.
And Meese, for similar reasons, Meese represented the conservatism of the 1980s. He was a key figure in the conservative movement and used his position in the Reagan years to advance the cause of conservatism. And I think Clark, still represented that 1960s year and continued to be very vocal and active after he left office on big issues of the day. And that can be a function of these attorneys general. Meese remained very important, again, just comparing him to Clark, at talking about ideas and issues even after they left office. I think it's a healthy function that they could have.
Let's go to the phones to Daniel in Rice Lake. Hello, Daniel. What's in your mind?
Hello. Nixon's Attorney General Kleindienst resigned and was replaced by Defense Secretary Richardson. Nixon ordered Richardson to fire Special Prosecutor Cox. Richardson failed to fire Cox and immediately resigned. His deputy also resigned, and Bork, as acting attorney general, fired Cox. Became known as the Saturday Night Massacre. Wasn't Attorney General Richardson an authentic American hero?
That would probably, many people think so. The Saturday night, the whole controversy over Cox and over the firing, for many people, I think, became a symbol of why you do need people in the Attorney General position who will uphold the law. And the kind of initial refusal to carry out Nixon's order, yes, leaves him in the eyes of many as one of the better figures in the administration. But also, it plays into this argument of what happens when you have people who will not follow the law, but instead follow the wishes of the president. In that case, you didn't, and the president ran roughshod over the people who were refusing to listen to him. Watergate, for many Americans, is a reminder of what happens when there's no check on an administration, not just from outside the administration, but from within. And it's to the attorney general that the country looks, to prevent things like Watergate and the cover-up and attempt to block the investigation, which is what Nixon did and what several people in that office tried to stop.
Do you see a parallel between events then and events today?
We have to see. I mean, I'm not sure we've hit the severity of Watergate at this point. Maybe we have. I don't think it's clear yet. We need a little time, and we need to see how this unfolds. But there are parallels. I mean, this is ultimately a debate not just about Gonzalez or not just about FISA and the war on terrorism. It's a debate about executive power in America. And what's floating, what's circulating around all these hearings is how much power does the executive have to act without any kind of restraint and without any kind of congressional interference. It was the same thing with Watergate. And part of the explosion of Watergate was an explosion over presidential power. There's just too much. I think we're dealing with some of those issues right now, and certainly Democrats in Congress are not going to relent on this question in the next few years. It's something that not only is important politically, but many legislators personally feel this is a White House that is not accountable and that there are a lot of resemblances to the Nixon administration, that we're seeing potentially kind of another Watergate era.
If Elliot Richardson was seen as an American hero by many people at that time, are there other attorneys general who have outstanding records or have been considered to be among the leaders in this post?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, look, there are many people who look very well to Robert Kennedy, who we discussed, or his successor, Nicholas Katzenbach, who was very instrumental under Lyndon Johnson in making sure the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was followed. And there's been a lot of very good discussions about what he accomplished through this position to advance the revolution in civil rights policy that took place in that era. And so many people, I think, look up to him who are supporters of what that era was about. Meese, again, who, again, is involved in corruption, is forced to resign because of a WedTech scandal, still remained a hero to many conservatives. At Justice Department, he staffed justice with people like Sam Alito, who is currently on the Supreme Court, and he put forth arguments about executive power that many conservatives do like today. So despite his own involvement in a scandal that didn't have to do with his role as Attorney General, it predated it, many people see Meese as a very important figure. I think Kennedy and Katzenbach, just in terms, though, of what they did in the position and the laws they enforced, are extremely important. You know, another under Homer Cummings, who was in the 1930s the Attorney General, is very important to the increasing federal role in law issues, in crime issues. And many people think that he was quite important in really revolutionizing what the Justice Department was about and what the federal government could do in terms of what had been a very local issue before.
Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. We talked earlier about Martha Mitchell brought up her name. She was calling reporters at night and insisting that she was being kept hostage at times. And an unidentified caller wondered if you would speak to the speculation about her death at the hands of the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
I don't. That's not really something I could comment on.
All right.
I'm just not familiar with that.
All right. Thanks very much for that. We're talking about loyal friends as Attorney General and what has happened so far in history. You've indicated that that probably shouldn't be the litmus test for future Congresses as they talk about candidates and go through the confirmation hearings. Talk a little bit more about that.
I mean, it shouldn't be a litmus test, but it should be a very central issue. I mean, I think in general it's better to, I wrote this in the Huffington Post, it's better not to have friends and very loyal advisors as Attorney General. People have a long history of the president are going to be the weakest in terms of avoiding and resisting the pressure to make decisions based on politics rather than based on the law. And I think Congress just has to accept that, and you might lose people who are very good, but on the other hand, you might diminish the kind of problems you face right now. You know, ideally, you want someone who is very strong in terms of their experience with the law and with law enforcement and who has a real dedication to upholding the laws of this country, even if that means going after the president who appointed them. And I think that's what Congress should be looking for. But all the warning signs were there with Gonzalez. I mean, I think it's shocking in terms of what might have happened or what we're learning about as the fact that Congress wasn't tougher in considering who Gonzalez was and what that could lead to once he was in power. So it shouldn't be a litmus test, but it should be absolutely central, and I think it's something in general to avoid.
When we look at the record of the current Attorney General, some would say that he's lied to Congress under oath. He may have participated in an illegal purge of some state attorney general for suspicious reasons that may include illegally influencing elections. Should we, or how do you change the situation where the Attorney General has a role in the firings or the decision to fire these state attorneys general?
Well, ultimately, that's about the politics of Justice Department, meaning that you need to have some kind of rules and regulations that diminish how political that office can be. It's always been a political office. It's never been free from political decision-making. But what's troubling people right now is this idea that prosecutors are fired in order to advance the cause of the Republican Party in 2006, and that corruption cases wouldn't be investigated because the Republican administration doesn't want them to be investigated, or that allegations of voting fraud and voting abuse would be pursued or not pursued because of what's in the interest of the Republican Party. And so, look, we have rules about what politicians can or can't do, from ethics rules to civil service rules. And I think now if we do something constructive from the scandal beyond, you know, how we treat Gonzalez and in the administration, it would be to make sure there are ways to prevent decision-making and justice from being guided by politics. You know, when we're dealing with the area of law, I think most Americans want politics as far away as possible. And so, you know, we've had reforms of departments before, and if we just had reforms of Congress. So there's no reason those kind of changes can't be made in justice in terms of decisions over firing so that they're more closely monitored.
Is it possible that the Attorney General, Gonzalez, could be in some legal difficulty internationally because of his writings about torture?
That's a good question. I mean, perhaps. Obviously, the decisions that came out in 2002 and 2003 are not just domestic. These have had international ramifications, and they involve policies that are not actually conducted in the United States. They're conducted outside our borders. So does some kind of international body charge him? Perhaps. I think it's unlikely. I mean, most presidents tend to avoid that, and it's hard to imagine him being dragged out in that venue in the coming years. But obviously, the bigger point is that his decisions and writings have had really huge international consequences, is a good one.
If people look at the attorney generals, the state attorney generals that were fired, then they might conclude that there is an attempt to rig the 2008 election. Is that a concern of yours?
Of course, of course. I mean, I think, you know, many people dismiss the issue about the firings as not that important. That much more important is the discussion of secrecy and FISA and did Gonzalez lie about, you know, what the government was doing in terms of surveillance and what they were advising Congress on. But I actually think the other issue is quite important. I mean, the charges are that justice used its power back in 2006 in an effort to try to, rig the elections or to improve Republican chances in many elections. And if the same thing is going to affect 2008, I think that should be very troubling. Look, we don't want investigations of real corruption to happen or not happen because of a president telling the Justice Department to back off. That gets us right back to Watergate. And so I think it's very troubling, and that part of the investigation now, it shouldn't just be about what happened, but what's happening or what's going to happen before 2008. We have to make sure that's not the case.
You are writing History of the Politics of National Security. Talk a little bit about that book that will be coming up.
I'm writing a book that basically looks at how politics never stops at the water's edge, and it goes back to World War II and shows how national security has been deeply embedded in our politics and how parties fight each other and how elections take place, and that the issue of what the government does abroad to keep war and peace or how the government tries to avoid threats within the United States has been a central, often forgotten issue in, you know, crass American political fights, and it's been very important to the fortunes of the parties and to how elections have shaped up over time. And I'm looking at issues like the Cuban Missile Crisis and looking just at how political they were. So the politicization of national security isn't something new to the George Bush era, and it goes back a long time, and that's really what I've been finding in my research.
Wasn't there a spirit of bipartisanship, though, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, or do you see that's where the fabric begins to tear apart?
It tears apart even before that. I mean, what I've found is the spirit of bipartisanship that we talk about was never so strong. Even at the height of the Cold War in the late 40s and early 50s, already the parties are in fierce competition using this issue on the campaign trail. Republicans in 1952 really use it quite viciously against Democrats, for example, against Adlai Stevenson. And national security is never as bipartisan as we remember. There are moments of bipartisanship, but this has always been very, very political, and the parties have been always willing to use this to tear at one another.
John in Milwaukee, let's get you into the conversation. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a question about how Ramsey Clark was appointed to Attorney General. I was under the impression that he may have been appointed so his father, who was a Supreme Court justice, would resign and Johnson could appoint Thurgood Marshall. And I never was convinced one way or the other that that was true or not.
That is, I've heard that as well, and that is one of the arguments that's been floated. I don't think we have an exact answer. I mean, I think the best thing to look at is biographies of Clark and biographies of Johnson. You'll basically see a debate over whether that's true, but that's probably as good as I could get myself. I'm not an expert on Clark, but that is an argument made.
Okay.
Yep.
Thanks a lot.
All right, John, thank you very much for the call. Talking with Julian Zelizer, who is a professor of history and public affairs in the Department of History at Princeton University, mentioned the book that you've got coming out on politics of national security. And then, of course, they'll follow that next year with the book that you co-authored, Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 1970s. And give us a snapshot of that.
Yeah, that's a book. It's coming out next spring, and it's 14 leading historians writing about how important the 1970s were. I mean, that's a decade we often forget. It's sandwiched in between the 60s and the drama of the 60s and the conservative 1980s, but what we found in this book was the 70s was really the crucial moment, a crucial period as American politics changed, economics changed, and in many ways, it's the history of today. You can see in the 1970s. I mean, for example, that's when the conservative movement really comes of age in America and starts to influence national debate. So it's kind of recovering a lost decade with some really exciting historians writing from everything from, you know, how popular movies and television covered issues such as the family to article on the Carter administration and its battles with the right wing in the Republican Party.
Wasn't that when Mission Impossible was like the number one program on television?
That's right. Many of our shows offer some clues into the psyche of the era.
Thanks very much for spending the hour with us. It's been a lot of fun and very enlightening.
Thank you.
Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's writing A History of the Politics of National Security, which will be published by Yale University Press. You can follow his post in the Huffington Post about Congress should avoid loyal friends as AG. I'm Jim Packard. Thanks to Martinez White for on-air phone production. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.